Probably inflammation is a big one. Yeah? It's something that's common to all disease. Shifting nutrients, how nutrients are used in the body is another one. Okay, so that's a big one. Not a lot of mechanistic data with the whole cow model, a lot of in vitro data, but there's been some work with mastitis, some work with inducing uterine disease. And in a snapshot, as a general rule, disease that have an inflammatory nature, which most of them have one way or another, they're just bad. They only cause damage. And reproduction is one of the first things to suffer and one of the last things to recover. And that's probably results in what we see in the field, which is fewer pregnant cows.
We want to thank the innovative companies and products whose support and trust make this podcast possible. Adiseo USA, producers of Smartamine M and MilkPay.com. Mycotoxins can threaten feed and cattle performance. DSM Firmenich offers a portfolio of solutions to help mitigate the impact of mycotoxins in your feed. Asepsis, an ounce of prevention. With early detection in health, reproduction, and feeding, Smax Tech future-proofs your dairy operation. Excellent, a novel product for the management of hypocalcemia. It's uncomplicated excellence. Volac, unlocking ruminant potential through nutritional solutions for a sustainable future. Priority IAC, the only company bringing the fields of microbiology and nutrition together.
Welcome back to the Dairy Podcast Show. My name is Barry Bradford from Michigan State University, and today we're very happy to welcome back a former guest on the show, Dr. Jose Santos from the University of Florida. Thanks for joining us again, Jose.
Well, thank you, Barry, for having me again here.
I can see the sun is shining there in sunny Florida, not so much in Michigan, pretty typical. Can you fill us in a little bit or get us up to speed on what the dairy program at Florida looks like these days? Do you guys have a big number of undergrads, or is it more of a graduate student program?
Yeah, so I would say it's a mixture. We don't have a big dairy science program in the undergraduate program because the typical undergraduate in animal science now has really moved, and I've seen that in many programs, into animal biology or pre-vet type of thing. So our undergraduate program total is about, I believe, 600 or 700 students, but the vast majority is in animal biology, and a smaller component, maybe 10%, is into animal production, which would include dairy, beef emphasis, livestock emphasis. Yeah, I think that's the nature of the beast today with undergraduates. A lot of them more interested in coming to animal science programs, not because of the production aspect, but maybe because of the biological component, studying animals from a biology point of view, and also setting them up to perhaps move into a professional program like veterinary colleges.
Yep.
At least that's been my experience here.
Yeah, I think you're right.
But we do have a big dairy science program in the graduate program. We have an excellent relationship with the veterinary college. We have wonderful colleagues just across the road here, and we do a lot of things together. Between us in animal science, we probably have, of our total faculty members, I think we are 37 total, probably 12 or 13 are primarily dairy focused. And then we have in the food animal program in the veterinary college another 4 or 5 colleagues, and we do a lot of things together, either research or mentoring grad students or teaching or seminars. So, and that's been a great collaboration.
I guess probably both departments have access to a research facility that you guys do a lot of your work at?
That is correct, yeah. So both, anybody here at University of Florida has access to the University of Florida dairy unit. So we milk just shy of 500 cows. It's a dairy that was built many, many years ago. We all wish we could go through the renewal like you guys are going in Michigan State. That would be a blast for us. It's a very active program. We use every cow in the farm continuously, as you can imagine. Now, one experiment ends, the next person comes in with the next one. So, yeah, those cows are bread and butter. Although many of us still do a lot of field work. My colleagues and myself go to commercial farms for experiments.
Our Yeast 40 is a natural biotechnology from ICC,
designed to boost the health and productivity of animals under challenging production systems. Our Yeast 40 performance is supported by an unique processing technology that results in a pure product containing high levels of beta-glucans, MOS, and yeast metabolites. These factors, combined, promote the ruminal and intestinal modulation, helping the animals to reach their full potential.
And what about the Florida dairy industry? I mean, what we're seeing nationally, pretty much everywhere, is consolidation, right? But I think there's a handful of states that are growing rapidly in terms of cow numbers. A few are declining. What's that look like in Florida right now?
Yeah, so Florida is probably the original large dairy state. It was probably the first place in which, quote-unquote, larger farms were built in the late 60s, early 70s, close to Miami and what's called now, they move up to what's called the Okeechobee area, where Lake Okeechobee is. Yep. And then that mold moved into the western states, California being one, and then now the Midwest and probably more recently, there's really big farms in Iowa in the I-29 corridor. Eh? So our industry, as any other place, has shrunk in terms of numbers of licensed farms that produce milk. Mm-hmm. We still have the same number of cows, at least since I've been here. I've been here 16 years. We had 130,000 dairy cows. We still have approximately 130,000 dairy cows. The latest number that I've seen, there's only 60 licensed dairy farms in the state of Florida. So we are seeing the same phenomenon, which is cow numbers maintain, they just change hands, and there are fewer owners. And a handful of big producers represent the biggest chunk of the total milk produced. And that's our story here.
And correct me if I'm wrong, what I think about with Florida is two things is maybe that are tied together is one, probably more heat stress than anybody else in the U.S. has to deal with. And then two, maybe tied to that, because it's a major milk deficit state, probably the highest mailbox milk prices in the country. Is that correct?
Yeah. So Florida is a tough environment for hosting cow. Yeah. It is not easy. So we have our fair share of hot and humid. So we don't necessarily have the highest temperatures like
right.
Nevada, California, Arizona, but humidity makes things a lot more difficult. So heat stress easily, depending upon where you are in Florida, will be 4 to 8 months. If you are in South Florida, 8 months out of the year, your fans and soakers are on 24 hours a day. If you are where we are here, North Central Florida and North, I would say probably from April until October and the months of June, July, August, mid-September, really tough on cows.
Yeah.
So it's like you live in Michigan and in February you need to go somewhere to see a little bit of sunshine. Our cows need to go somewhere to get a break from the summer. So that's one thing. Yes, we are deficient in milk. Our milk market is all fluid. We used to get a big differential in price, which is no longer the case.
Okay.
There's enough milk coming in from other places. Yeah. So you go to a grocery store in Florida, you find milk from all kinds of brands that come from everywhere in the country, particularly when you get these big companies in the distribution line like Coca-Cola and others. Yeah, they can put milk anywhere. And that has affected. We used to be differential price, which you still have some compared to what I've seen in the national milk market, but not as advantageous anymore, I would say, given the challenges with the environment that we have. And one thing you didn't mention is, although we can grow forages almost all year round, let's say you can have at least two crops a year, our yields are less because our soil fertility is not like Iowa soil. We have a lot of disease pressure. Yeah, corn, we don't have a lot of genetics for alfalfa that does well here. So we're very dependent on corn silage, some subtropical grasses, cynodon like Tifton, cynodon grasses like Bermuda grasses, and some winter forage. But our yields depend upon where you are in the state. then your soil fertility can be much less or lower than other places in the country.
Yeah, okay.
And it's hard to produce milk with a lot of hot weather and not great forage NDF quality. So,
but then you see some of the data on what some of the dairies there in Florida achieve, and it's impressive. There's obviously some outstanding managers there and great
researchers. That is correct, yes.
So speaking of great researchers, I think, you know, one of the things that stands out about you, Jose, is that you bring your background training in veterinary medicine and also, you know, the PhD work you did and all the years of research in nutrition. And you probably combine those as well as anybody I know. And I thought today we could talk a little bit about something you've worked on off and on and others have as well, is trying to understand what leads to reproductive success in dairy herds or successful reproductive programs. Get us started on that, will you? Like, what today, if do you know the numbers for what you would consider a good benchmark for a 21-day pregnancy rate, for example, and what explains some of the variation across herds?
Yeah, so I don't have the latest values, but the data that CDCB collects, because now we have genomics for daughter pregnancy rate, we have genomics for cow conception rate, so they get enough phenotype of that you can back calculate 21-day pregnancy rate. And my understanding from those data, probably U.S. today, U.S. herd is sitting in the low 20s as an average of the country. Okay, so our pregnancy per AI is just shy of 40%, 39% for first service. All service a little less. And then insemination rate, we are just above 50% as an industry. But we have an institution called the Dairy Cattle Reproduction Council. And they put together every year the top herds that are nominated for awards. And there are herds that you wouldn't believe. Yeah, they have 21-day cycle pregnancy rates in the 50 percentile. 50%. It's ridiculous, yeah?
Yeah.
You need two cycles to get a cow pregnant. Type of thing, yeah?
Like a beef herd, yeah.
Like a beef herd, yes. So once they start breeding, cows get pregnant very well. That's not the U.S. average, but U.S. average has moved up. From the time I started, we were probably in the low teens, like 13, 14. We focused at that time a lot on getting breeding to get a cow pregnant, but not breeding enough cows. And then there's a history behind all of that. The reproductive programs came along. We were able to inseminate many more cows. Producers learned how to implement that. It became more logical and less individual decisions. We made major progress with development of timed AI programs between the groups in Wisconsin with Milo and Bill Thatcher here in Florida and others that contribute data to that. So that was a major movement in favor of improving reproduction. But then came the impediments, which were implementation, you know, labor, human resources was an impediment, applying things properly. And also the other aspect, which is the host, the cow, yeah? How good this cow is to respond to those interventions. So I think we learned a lot over the years that the platform that we use today is a lot better than before, a lot more logical and science-based. And with that, we made many other improvements in cow comfort, animal handling, nutrition, health, that result where we are today with some herds achieving 30, 35, 40% pregnancy rates. Yeah? And when you get to that level, it's hard to justify a lot of investment because you are just, you know, as they say, kicking ass. Yeah. So you need to start looking for other issues on your farm. Yeah. At that stage.
So if you see herds today, and I'm sure there's not one answer, okay, so, but, you know, certainly we have benchmark herds that are pushing 40 or even better percent pregnancy rates. If you talk with a producer and, you know, they're still struggling in the low to mid 20s, what are some of the things that you usually can sniff out and when you start asking questions that might contribute to that?
So one of them that is difficult to have a great handle on it is the human resource. Yeah. How things are done in the farm. That's a tough one. You know, the social aspect, the human elements, it's a difficult one. If you just jump in if you're not there all the time to understand the details, you know, how people interact with each other. You got to clear a few hurdles, like if they use synchronization, do they apply that properly? You got to clear insemination techniques, semen handling, all these things that sometimes get overlooked, but can be pretty important. In the big scheme of things, other than human resources, is really the cow and the health of the cow. That plays a huge role on the success of reproduction on that herd. So when you see these herds that are in this very high reproductive performance, they breed a cow, they breed 10 cows and five get pregnant in a dairy farm. So they are doing a lot of good things to cows during the transition period, and they are probably having a lot less disease pressure. At the same time that if a cow gets sick, they know how to handle that sick animal to the best of what we know today. So I would say that those things have really changed over the years. And the whole aspect of cow comfort, we learn a lot from mistakes in the past. Yeah, I remember one time a good friend who became a dairyman but was a consultant at one point. So we are visiting a farm that has issues with barn design and stall size. And this producer is telling him, hey, I'm having all these lameness issues and this and that. And obviously the consultant goes and measures the stall, the height of the neck rail, the lunch space, all the things that we typically do, how much sand's in there. And he says, hey, your design is bad, it's flawed. And he said, hey, but I brought a consultant like you here when we designed this barn. And he says, that's exactly that. We learn from your mistakes and then we don't make the same mistake again. So when I will go to the next farm, I'll tell, don't build like him. So yeah, so we made major progress in cow comfort. And that has been a major thing because when you create issues for cows, they respond with more disease, and disease is always bad for reproduction. Yeah. So I would say that that's a big thing that has changed over the years.
Excellent point. So I think it's both to like pure biologists and to dairy producers. I think everybody, it makes sense that an animal that has been unhealthy is likely to be less fertile. But I know you and Eduardo Ribeiro, when he worked with you, you guys made big contributions to putting some numbers to that, to seeing sort of what's the magnitude and exactly why. What are the processes that are disrupted in the reproductive cycle that lead to those disruptions? Can you talk me through what you guys found and how you got to those conclusions?
Yeah, so a lot of our data and from colleagues are from an epidemiological point of view because it's just hard to induce disease in a lot of cows, yeah? So it's cost prohibitive, animal care prohibitive. So based on the epidemiological data, I'll give you a few examples. If a cow flies through without any clinical disease compared to a cow that has a case of mastitis or metritis, the average loss in terms of pregnancy to first AI is in the magnitude of 15 percentage points. So it's pretty big.
Lost pregnancies?
Between the reduction in pregnancy per AI and the increase in pregnancy loss, you are in the magnitude of 15 percentage points. So from 40 to 25. So I breed a cow. I breed 100 cows, I get 40 pregnancies. If I breed 100 cows, I had disease in the first 3 to 6 weeks of lactation, I get only 25 pregnancies. It's a big loss. There's lots of components to that. Once you have disease, the ability of that cow to cycle sooner is delayed and reduced. So now she's what we call an ovular for a longer period of time. In a long periods of an ovulation, it's sort of a blemish in her record. She won't show estrus, and if you breed, depending upon, there's some biology behind that, the pregnancy will be less and the risk of pregnancy loss will be greater. So that's one. But if you think in the big scheme of things, there is components of evolutionary biology there. Yeah? So the priority is not to get pregnant, it's to survive if you have uncertainty. Disease brings uncertainty in the life of the cow. Yeah?
Yes.
So somebody up higher, design and evolution made us that, hey, if I have a threat to my life, I don't want to carry another burden, which is a pregnancy. So there has to be checks and points and mechanisms to prevent that animal from becoming pregnant, which goes against dairy production because we want that cow to be pregnant timely, yeah? So what's the underlying mechanism? That's a big question. A lot of people working on that. Eduardo's still working on that. I have colleagues. You have done some work on that. Probably inflammation is a big one. Yeah? It's something that's common to all disease. Shifting nutrients, how nutrients are used in the body is another one. Okay, so that's a big one. Not a lot of mechanistic data with the whole cow model, a lot of in vitro data, but there's been some work with mastitis, some work with inducing uterine disease. And in a snapshot, as a general rule, disease that have an inflammatory nature, which most of them have one way or another, they're just bad. They only cause damage. And reproduction is one of the first things to suffer and one of the last things to recover. And that's probably results in what we see in the field, which is fewer pregnant cows. Yeah.
To me, one of the most interesting pieces of the work that you've done is, and this is over, maybe we should mention, this is over across the different data sets you've looked at, 10,000 cows, something like that, probably.
Yeah.
You guys have, my takeaway was that there's really no evidence of a greater negative effect of uterine disease versus non-uterine, right? Like mastitis or even things like ketosis, right? We're associated with sort of an equally bad negative effect on reproductive function.
I don't want to get into the details of things that are infectious in nature and things that are just metabolic because they have relationships. Yeah. So when we find a cow with high ketones, they're probably in a very catabolic state. Yeah.
Yep.
Some cows just fly along and that's fine. But when they have other underlying issues that sometimes we don't detect and that's an issue. Yeah.
Yep.
So we see what we see and there's a lot we cannot see. Then obviously it has implications to reproduction. So if she is in negative nutrient balance for a long period of time, a cow wasn't designed for that. It's not, you know, we often compare cows to marine mammals that lose 25-30% of their body weight because they produce milk like it's butterfat type of milk, yeah?
Yep.
And the pups suck that quickly. But those animals, we make those comparisons and they live with that. They were designed for that. Cows were not necessarily designed to face that. We changed the design of the mammary gland. We made them eat a lot more to produce a lot more milk. But we haven't changed the liver to the same extent, I like to think. So they're still herbivore that doesn't absorb a lot of glucose. The liver is not lipogenic. You know, all those things, yeah.
Right.
Biology behind. So beyond that, if you have lack of nutrients, there are plenty of signals. The brain and what controls reproduction is tightly related to what controls appetite and greatly influenced, as you know very well because of your work with Mike Allen, by the gut. This gut-brain axis is a very close relationship. So there's lots of signals coming from the GI tract and the glands associated with that to the brain telling her, don't cycle if you're losing a lot of weight. I know that the fight is, hey, you're measuring ketones and ketones are not bad because ketones, it's an elaborate system to conserve energy, but it's a symptom, yeah? It's a symptom of catabolism. And regardless of being the ketosis doing that, but it's the catabolic state when disease sets in that impedes proper reproduction. So I would say that people who are achieving these very high levels, they are doing a superb job with their employees and their staff in managing transition cows that we just have less disease pressure in early lactation. And one thing that I give a lot of credit to the veterinary community, my colleagues in food production departments, that they've done a lot of research on therapeutics now. It's no longer the veterinary medicine of the past that I think, you think, and we think, and let's have a beer and decide how we treat this case. Yeah? So now it's based on quantitative data, large experiments. So we know a lot better now what works, what doesn't work, and when things actually work in terms of therapy for mastitis, metritis, the common disease that you can use medical intervention. So that's been a plus.
Absolutely. Seen a huge change in the last 20 years there.
Natural Biologics is using cutting-edge science to deliver cost-effective solutions for the animal health and productivity challenges you face. For conventional or organic production systems, Natural Biologics can help support rumen health and immune function, mitigate pathogens, and increase production efficiency. Visit naturalbiologics.com to learn more.
So that leads into maybe a good takeaway message. So, you know, not everybody listening to this is working with herds that are, you know, the top 1% in terms of transition health and stuff. If you're talking with a manager for the first time and they want to know, you know, what's the most important things I need to do to have a more successful transition cow program, what's at the top of your list?
Don't bother cows too much.
Okay.
Yeah. Let them, in the environment that you have, behave like cows, like handling cows, doing things. Use rational methods. Don't overkill doing things, I would say.
Yep.
You got to put a lot of emphasis on cow comfort. If your cows are distressed, the odds are that you're going to suffer from more disease. You have to do the basics. You know, people in mastitis have done a great job. You got to eliminate some pathogens that should not be part of your book anymore. Shouldn't have many of the contagious mastitis anymore. Should be eliminated and contained to the best that it can be done on a farm. You got to train employees so they understand why they do the things they do. Mm-hmm. So giving them knowledge becomes power. It can't be just do what I tell you what you should do. They need to have some understanding why they are doing those things. So they treat that as if it is their own, yeah? And yep. That is a big thing, particularly as we move to larger herds that the owner is not necessarily involved on a day-to-day decisions and management. Okay? And then have a good team of consultants that help you navigate through that in terms of diet formulation to prevent disease, veterinary care. So you got to bring a team of people that train your employees that are dealing, they are putting the fires away, but also are educating them, and they implement science-based type of solutions. Yeah. So I think if you want to move from the bottom to the top, you have to start thinking with that kind of mentality. Sometimes it's more difficult. You may not have the financial infrastructure to change your physical infrastructure in the dairy.
Right.
It's a tough one. But I think still in many places, even with the limitations that they have, they can probably still do better relative to how they handle animals such that they minimize the risk of problems.
Great insights. I like that. It's interesting that the first thing you said is don't bother cows too much. Don't, you know, you and I are scientists, you know, we do studies where we're biopsying animals, we're bleeding cows and stuff, but I've come more and more, you know, from observing farms and seeing changes on farms and how they affect cows that, I don't know, excessive monitoring of fresh cows, I think is more harm than good in most cases.
Yeah. So when we do experiments now, I always think about that. When I start my career, and I had a chance to do control experiments of the cows are there for the experiment. It was an overkill. We tried to do too much.
Yeah.
And we hurt cows in mass response potentially. So now we have, hey, this is the key response. We'll do everything we can to not affect that.
Yep.
Yeah. And then we take a few things, but we no longer do so many things that requires intervention with each cow all the time. Because we know that will affect particularly intake and in production, yeah? And that is a key. Those are two key things. Yeah? So you don't want to compromise production because that pays the bills, yeah?
Yes.
We want to thank the innovative companies and products whose support and trust make this podcast possible. Maximize profitability and herd health with early detection in animal health, reproduction, and feeding. The most advanced bolus technology and professional support from agricultural experts make this possible with SmaxTech, the health management system that future-proofs your dairy operation.
Okay, one thing I wanted to ask you to wrap up the conversation today. Well, those of us in academia at least see a huge well, influx of hardworking, intelligent Brazilian scientists into our community, and they're having a huge impact. But I was thinking, you know, you've helped train a lot of those people. You've had a big impact by helping, you know, bring some really talented people to the U.S. I was thinking, you know, so you've been a part of a lot of sort of welcoming people to the U.S. Is there one or two things that stand out to you that over the years you've learned to sort of explain to people about cultural differences? And it could be within the ag community or just the U.S. versus Brazil. Are there a couple things that really stand out to you about the differences that help people navigate that transition?
I find U.S. easy, very welcoming.
Okay.
Yeah. So I was always treated with a lot of respect here. Never had any complaints, to be 100% honest. But Brazilians, by nature, we are intrusive. We like to know details of personal lives, whereas in the U.S., that's a little less, yeah? Okay. So if you put two Brazilians together, the first thing they start asking is, do you know this person? Do you know that person? Although one lives in California, the other one lives in New York, but they know somebody in California, New York. That's very typical. Okay. So that's our nature. But regardless of that, so we asked lots of personal things that probably here, it takes a little longer until you have that kind of intimacy with people. But one thing that is critical for the success of those people and probably was important for me is to be able to communicate. Yeah. So if you come here and it is a shock, less so now because the English language is spread all over and access to that is so much easier than in my time and probably before me. Yeah. So yeah, feeling embarrassing when you first come here and you don't know how to communicate and you feel really mad because there's a three-year-old walking by and speaks perfect English, and you cannot say thanks. So learning English when they come, it's a big plus. So the ones that quickly adapt are the ones that are able to overcome that initial barrier. But I would say one of the major strengths of the U.S. is that you are a welcoming country to foreigners. And I think that is a big benefit to the country because you are capable of bringing people that benefit society, yeah? Although there's all these issues and debates relative to immigration, but immigration has been a very positive thing to this country. And when I go to other big economies, very developed countries around the world, I would say a big difference is this entrepreneur type of mentality of the United States and the ability to attract people of all kinds of things, you know, from very rich scientists, farm workers, anything that will benefit society. And we should be very happy about that.
Well, Jose, as always, I enjoy talking to you. I always learn many things. And I appreciate you taking the time to be on the show today.
Well, thank you for having me, Barry. It's a big pleasure. So congratulations on this program. I listened to the podcast. I really enjoyed that. Thank you.
Fantastic. Again, this has been Dr. Jose Santos from the University of Florida, and you've been listening to another episode of the Dairy Podcast Show. Make sure you follow so you don't miss the next episode, and we'll see you next time.
Do you feel overwhelmed with mundane tasks that eat up your valuable time? It's time to reclaim your schedule and focus on what truly matters. Get your time back with elite remote talent without the time zone hassle. Delegate $10 an hour tasks to focus on your $1,000 an hour tasks. Schedule your free strategy call at wisevas.io.